This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode number 21 of the Beersmith Podcast. I got a quick update. In September, we do have a new update coming for Beersmith 2, so keep an eye out for that. Had a great response to the new version, so thank you for your continuing support, and thank you also for supporting this podcast. Today, my guest on the show is Sean Paxton, the homebrew chef. Now, Sean runs a website called homebrewchef.com, and he also does a podcast on the Brewing Network, which is called The Homebrewed Chef. Sean, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Brad. Great to be here.
Now, Sean, you've carved out sort of a unique niche here, pairing food with different beers, and also, you've sort of become the homebrewing chef for the entire homebrewing community, which is certainly a unique thing. And I got to meet you when you did the grand banquet at the AHA conference, and I really enjoyed that. How did you actually get in the business of becoming the go-to chef for homebrewers?
That's a great question. I think a lot of it has to do with luck, the right place at the right time. I have been cooking with beer, though, for over 17 years. So it's been at least fun for me, because just to see the whole industry grow, both in home brewing and craft beer itself, to really see just the explosion of flavors and taste and beer styles and just, you know, across the board, all these wonderful flavors. And as a chef, I look at flavors slightly different, especially go with food. And I've been doing a lot of beer dinners. Probably close to 15 years I've been doing a lot of big beer dinners, and those dinners have evolved and grown to the point where there are 12 to 15 courses at some different locations. The one that we did for the National Homebrew Conference, I mean, you know, that was 1,500 people, three courses, so 4,500 plates worth of food all in one evening in a pretty short period of time. So, you know, it takes a lot of skill sets, and, you know, it's been fun to kind of look back at my career and all the different things I've done, from catering to the restaurants to the fine dining, you know, have all culminated in what it is today. So
I mean, this is your full-time job, though. I mean, this is what you do now, right?
Yeah, this is between this and writing for different magazines and my podcast and the dinners and a few of the other projects I'm working on outside of just what you guys see, you know, from Twitter and Facebook and whatnot. This is full-time, if not more than full-time. So
fantastic. And I enjoyed your website. I looked at it's the homebrewed chef. I'm sorry, homebrewchef.com. It was very, very interesting.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I'm actually in the process right now of just tweaking the format and switching everything over to a whole new thing. And there's going to be a whole bunch of new content here probably in the next month or so. So really excited to have you guys be able to see that, because there's a lot of stuff I've been doing, and I haven't fully updated the site that's currently on there because I've been putting all the new stuff for the new site. So a lot of stuff to look forward to.
Well, I looked on Amazon the other day, and there was about actually several thousand books listed for pairing food with wine, but I only found about four or five books on pairing food with beer, which is one of your specialties. Why do you think that is? Why is wine such a popular topic for pairing food and beer is not?
It's a travesty, in my humble opinion. I think beer has always been somehow associated with, you know, the blue collar worker and more of just a beverage for, you know, quenching your thirst. When it comes down to actually pairing and using beer and food, you know, I think a lot of people don't understand it. I think it's a lot more complex than wine because of the bitterness component, as well as, you know, what is wine? It's fermented grape juice. Now, granted, there's different varietals of grapes and how you trellis them and the soil conditions and the region they come from and all the other things that a sommelier will be able to ascertain from tasting a sample of wine. But when it comes to beer, I think that they get very confused because we can't limit it to just those things, you know, and it's so much more broad because if you think about the varieties of hops, the varieties of malt, the roasting of those different malts, and then you think about the yeast and then the water chemistry, you know, and just in beer, and, you know, that's more just your classic beer. And then you start to look at all the other ingredients you could add in between honey and different sugars from Belgium to spices to herbs to vegetables to fruits. I mean, it's pretty endless. And I think that that almost becomes too overwhelming. And it's interesting, at least to me right now, because, you know, those four or five books really are kind of outdated. And I'm really working on coming up with a new kind of format with that to really showcase, again, the beers and looking at the beers and ingredient, which I think a lot of people miss. You know, it's not just adding that can of beer to a chili. You know, I hate that. I hate that reference, because now there's, you know, 50 different beers you could get in can. And if you add that single beer, your chili might not be the same as it was. So.
So let's start with some simple pairings. What styles of beer go best with, you know, some of the foods that we commonly eat?
Well, that's a great question. And actually, I struggle with that a little bit because, you know, I look at that almost in that wine terminology where, you know, the reds go with this, the whites go with that. And it's not quite that simple. And if anything, I don't want it to really be that simple because there's a lot of flavors. And this is where I really recommend your listeners and people who follow me just to really stop and taste the beer. And I know it sounds really elementary, but to really taste the beer where it's not just, you know, going down your throat and it's, you know, thirst quenching and everything else with it. But, you know, the carbonation, how strong is the carbonation? That's going to change how it's going to pair with food. You know, if your food is a lot heavier or fattier, richer, you know, the more bitter that's found in the beer, whether it's an IPA or other styles, will really work to really showcase, you know, and actually add balance. Because think about how we add, or when we're brewing beer, we add hops to balance out the malt, right? And it's finding that key balance between the sweetness and that bitterness. Now with food, I think it's the same way. You know, if you look at like your roastier beers, your stouts, your porters, your imperial stouts, you know, they have that astringency because of the roasted malt. That is actually going to work very similarly to the bitterness in like an IPA or a pale ale, and or even a double IPA for that matter. And depending on the food and how fatty it is or rich it is, that can actually help add that balance to actually cut that fat, to cut that richness. And again, the reverse, where, you know, you look at like a Belgian triple and it works great with some fishes, but it won't work with every fish. And so to really have this blanket statement, I don't really always find it works.
So can you give us one or two examples though? I mean, I had Randy Mosher on the other day and he said, for example, an IPA goes great with carrot cake. Have you got a couple similar examples of odd pairings that might work really well?
That does sound really good. I like, you know, Rodenbach Grand Cru, I think is a really fun food friendly beverage. I find it works great, both with duck, also with cherries to do. I just did a recipe for a Rodenbach Grand Cru, cherry pie for Beer Advocate magazine. And that I thought was just phenomenal because the natural cherry flavor along with, the Roselaire yeast strain that has a lot of those dried fruit complexities, you know, and that pairing I think is just elementary and it really works as a great building point. But, you know, a nice roasty brown ale, you know, would go great with a great piece of roasted pork. The sweetness of the pork and the roastiness that the beer has kind of plays up the Maillard reaction, especially in the cooking of the meat and how that protein kind of gets some extra flavor from that technique. And that beer really showcases that, I think, really nicely. But then again, you know, it's so subjective. You know, we all have slightly different taste buds, and that's what's kind of unique about this whole forum, you know, because there is so many different options and ideas, and it's just a matter of tweaking the ingredients right. So
fantastic. So you know, beer is also a great ingredient to cook with, as you mentioned earlier. Can you provide a few examples of cooking with beer?
Sure. I mean, again, it's pretty much endless as far as because there's so many different beers right now, whether you're a home brewer or a professional brewer or just a beer enthusiast, beer geek, you know, it's endless. You know, I just did some stuff with Sam from Dogfish Head, and we did some really fun dishes where we played up some of the classics. You know, we did a pastrami, where you think about corned beef, you know, and to corn your brisket, we took the Palo Santo that he does, which has a lot of umami flavors in it. All that wood essence really comes through in the beer, and we marinated that for about 6 days in this brine filled with spices as well. And after it came out of the brine, we layered it with black peppercorns and then popped it into the smoker, and we actually smoked it in cedar wood that he used on his show, Brewmasters, and then we finished it off with some Palo Santo wood at the very finish to make this amazing pastrami, and then we actually used that into a my version of a Reuben, where we use Gruyere cheese and kind of do a 2000 Island sauce, where, you know, there's a lot more ingredients in it besides just ketchup and mustard ketchup and mayonnaise, and we really tweak the flavor profile and have it on a great roll. And again, it's just those flavors and how that beer becomes an ingredient. You know, at the end when we actually shredded the beef, we had a little bit more beer just to reinforce those flavors. And I think it really came across nicely because the beer wasn't lost, the meat wasn't lost. And that's really the key when you do these different pairings and dishes, because it's not just the beer, it's not just the meat, you know, you can overshadow one with the other very easily. And so that's where I think to really slow down and think about, you know, what beer you're adding. You know, I had a guy on Twitter today asked me, hey, I have a coffee stout and I wanted to do a stew with it, what do you think? And first thing that popped into my mind was, you know, a red eye gravy. And I'm like, of course it would work, it would be great, you know, and just readjust your aromatics to make that work. So again, it's endless.
Now, last year you started a monthly podcast on the Brewing Network to talk about beer and food, and it's aptly named The Homebrewed Chef. Could you talk a few minutes about your new podcast?
Sure. It's been a lot of fun because for me, at least, you know, to give me a forum a little bit more to talk about these different flavors and all the different experiments I do within a month, and give people a chance to listen in and become a little bit more educated about what I'm getting educated on. And it's been great because the feedback has been wonderful. Our listenership has been wonderful. You know, we really try to dive into different things, everything from where your meat comes from to understanding what cuts of meat are probably better for braising versus grilling versus roasting. We've gotten into, you know, farmers markets and where our food comes from, and really kind of get back to some elementary, you know, things to stop and reconsider. You know, with that show, we really talked a lot about, you know, if you go to almost every grocery store in the country, they have the same products year round, and that's not really how Mother Nature provides things, and to really rethink and actually re-explore and become re-familiar with a lot of different ingredients that are very seasonal. That I mean, we shouldn't have peaches year round, but right now the peaches are phenomenal, and eat your fair share of them now and enjoy it. But you know, the peach will not be the same in 2 months or 3 months. Same with cherries, you know. So to rethink about how we eat is really a critical undertone of the show, and then to get people to also experiment more with different flavors of different beers, and to give people a place to, like, hey, I don't have any, you know, things on Google or, you know, different cookbooks, and I'm trying to find something to cook with this beer, with that, and I'm more than happy to give people that opportunity to say, hey, here's something that's different, here's something that's fun, and this would be great, and wow, that's a great idea, I might have to steal that one. So it's a lot of fun for me.
Now, on the podcast, you also talked about cooking turkey brined in beer, and I know you have a whole bunch of recipes on your website as well. Can you walk us through maybe that one recipe, just to give us a little bit of a sample here on today's show?
Oh, sure. You know, beer brine turkey, I think, is the best way to really cook a turkey because, one, the anatomy of a turkey, you know, it's such a large bird. It's not going to cook without being dry if you don't do some things to kind of give yourself just soften the corners, if you will. You think about the breast, you know, I mean, they're so huge, you know, on a turkey versus a chicken versus a Cornish game hen, you know, so it takes a lot longer to cook them. And if you have it at too high of a temperature in the oven, you know, they just kind of dry out and they become very bland and boring. And the thighs have a lot more juicy, fatty, you know, ness to that quality of meat. And so when you start to think about a beer brine, you can actually really influence the flavors of the turkey this way. And so depending on what style of beer you want to use or you have ready, and you know, you're going to need at least a six pack or a full growler of beer, but I think it's so worth it because what that beer does, you know, the alcohol helps transmit a lot of the flavors of the brine itself. And so I'm a huge component of, you know, using those basic flavor fundamentals, like with a mirepoix, whatnot. And so you can actually, you know, flavor your water carrot, celery, onions, fennel will also work well, shallots, garlic, depending on the beer. And you basically bring that to a simmer with sugar and some salt. Now, you can use honey, you can use brown sugar, all depending on, again, what style of beer you're using and what flavors it has. You know, if you look at something with Munich malt, that has a wonderful flavor, especially with a Maillard reaction of that particular roasted malt and what that does to turkey and fowl in general, you get a really nice maltiness that can come through, you know. And again, you don't want to use anything too bitter, but, you know, a good Bock or a good Dunkel would work really well. And you can actually infuse those flavors into the brine, and then you cool the brine down with cold beer and ice to thin it out just a little bit. And you have a large container. I know Ziploc sells some large, couple gallon size bags. Mm-hmm. You could even use your brew pot if that can fit in your fridge. And once the brine is below 40 degrees, you know, rinse your turkey off and basically submerge it into the brine. And depending on the size of your turkey, you know, anywhere between, you know, a 16 to 20 pound turkey is going to take about 24 to 36 hours to brine. If it's over 20 pounds, think 48 hours to 52 hours, depending on the size again. And what's happening is that in this kind of soaking, you know, spa treatment that you get, giving the turkey, you're actually using osmosis, which is you're sucking the natural juices that are found in the breast meat and the thigh meat and removing it, and by actually adding in that brine flavor into the meat. And over a period of time, what's going to happen is that's going to actually absorb those flavors. And then when you roast it, you've actually seasoned the bird from the inside out, not just from the outside in, like traditionally when we do a rub and stuff on the outside, and then cook it as normal.
Now, do you brine it in the fridge, or how do you do that?
Yes.
You leave it in the fridge for 36 hours or so?
To do it in the fridge, or if you have like a, you know, let's say that it's around Thanksgiving and you don't have room in your fridge, you can always use a nice cooler, like a, you know, camping cooler that mm-hmm. you have. Make sure it's, you know, rinsed with, you know, even I'll actually use my Star Sand just to sanitize it. And then at that point, you can actually put your ice cold brine in there and then put your turkey in. And then if you take a couple Ziploc bags, fill those up with ice, and then that will actually add some displacement. So again, that the turkey's covered, and also chill the turkey because you really don't want it to be above 40 degrees. So, and then from there, you know, it's best to actually pull the turkey out of the brine. You can pat it dry and let it warm up a little bit, you know, for about 2 hours on the counter, and then roast it off. So if you just readjust when you get your turkey before Thanksgiving or your event, you know, if it's not outside of Thanksgiving, you know, and you can use the same technique for a chicken or Cornish game hens or guinea fowl. I mean, it's pretty synonymous across the board with poultry. Duck, you don't really need a brine duck because it's a different style of meat proteins. But it's a great way to get these flavors in, and it actually really reinsures that your breast meat doesn't dry out and your thigh meat has lots of flavor, and across the board you get a much better turkey. And you tried the chicken at the National Homebrew Conference, you know, we brined all that in the Chipotle ale from Rogue, and that added a wonderful layer of complexity to the chicken itself, you know, with a little bit of spice. We added a lot of oregano and cilantro and onions and garlic, and all those flavors combined really brought that Mexican, Hispanic kind of undertone of flavors that the mole that we did just bounced off. And again, with the rice, you know, with the Maibach there, it was just a wonderful combination of flavors. Yeah, so again, it's really synonymous, you know.
Well, that kind of leads right into our next topic, which is, I mean, you go well beyond just food pairings or just throwing a little beer in with the food. I mean, you actually create what you call beer cuisine, which sort of reflects the flavors of the beer. So can you tell us a little bit about that process and what you're actually doing with some of your beer cuisine?
Sure. I mean, beer cuisine, you know, it's been referenced a lot, but if you try to look up a definition for beer cuisine, I haven't really found anything that really, to me, speaks to me where, you know, it's not just an afterthought, like, oh, I could add beer to this.
Right.
It's not that simple. You know, I really struggle a lot because if you really stop and think about beer, you know, so much goes into it. You know, for home brewers, you know, myself included, I can spend weeks, months, even years designing a recipe to get it just right and tweak it and get those flavors across. And then just to casually just dump it in something and hope that it works, it's not like gambling to me. And so I really want to ensure the odds that are much more successful. So if you stop and you really think about the flavors in that brew, and especially in today's market where there are so many unique beers that have so many unique flavor profiles, and then once you start to kind of pinpoint, wow, this with this kind of cuisine, and then start to overlay those flavors of the cuisine with that beer style, and kind of look at your point and counterpoint, so you have your sweet, your salty, your bitter, your sour, and then you start to kind of, okay, well, this beer is more sweet, or it's more roasty, or, you know, it's more bitter. And now I can start to think about, okay, now I want to add some of this and do some of that, and then actually manipulate the food recipe around that beer. Because think about it too. I mean, I can make a recipe for food in anything from 20 minutes to 5 hours, depending on how much time I have or longer. But a beer takes several weeks, if not months, and sometimes years to create. And so understanding that beer, I think, is really the fundamental of beer cuisine, you know, and to really stop and pay homage to that beer and that beverage, and thinking about how it will come across in the final dish, and so it's not lost. You know, you really want to make sure that, you know, it's respected, you know, and I really struggle with this a lot because I've been to different beer dinners, and sometimes the pairing is just so off. You know, it really makes the beer taste, you know, strange, or the food tastes weird, you know, or just like the flavors just don't mesh as well as they could. And that's where I really like to find, you know, when I do some of my dinners, I'll do two or three different beers to actually taste with the food. And so you can kind of see the point and the counterpoint right there in front, because what a great setting where it's not just that you're feeding your soul, but your mind and your creativity, because I found that this whole process has actually made me a much better brewer than just a chef.
Now, can you provide a few examples of beer cuisine? You know, a few of the dishes that you've created. I was sort of amazed with some of the ones you had at the AHA conference, but because they actually reflected the flavor of the beer, you know, and I thought that was very, very interesting. I've never seen a food designed like that, if you will. So can you provide a few of those examples for us, John?
Yeah, I mean, it's there's so much to talk about here, Brad.
Well, we got another 10 minutes or so. I'm just kidding. I mean, go ahead. Talk all you want.
A lot of my dinners, you know, I'll do, like, you know, at least, you know, six course, you know, every once in a while, like with the National Homebrew Conference, because of the budget and because of China and everything else, you know, to do anything more than a three course dinner there is pretty tricky. Yeah. The World Beer Cup dinner that I actually did with Randy Mosier last year, you know, that was 2,000 brewers from across the country and actually the world for, what was it, 44 different countries. And we did, so it was 2,000 people. We had five courses. So it was 10,000 plates worth of food, wow, you know, all in one evening. And so you start to look at how complex it can be.
Maybe could you walk us through one meal with maybe five or six courses and you know, give us an example of what it might look like?
Sure. I just did an event with Brower's Cafe and Firestone Walker for Seattle Beer Week. And what was really fun with this event was we did some really unique, different things that, you know, I really enjoyed. And the whole premise was Cajun Creole food. And so we started out and we did, you know, again, looking at Firestone's beers and their whole beer lineup and what flavors that they have, and to really redesign the food around those beers. And so we did some really fun things and some real fun, tricky little things that were actually kind of things that you could do at home. We started the dinner off with my Creole prawns, which Paul Prudhomme does some really fun prawns and some great food, and I think he's kind of like the godfather of Creole and Cajun cuisine. And so we took a Pale 31, which, you know, has a lot of citrus notes and everything else to it, and but it's light, it's not too heavy, not a lot of caramel malts in it. And so we actually used that as a brine to actually kind of like marinate brine the large prawns that we had, that we had done basically a butterfly cut. So we've deveined them and actually gone all the way, split them in half all the way up to the tail. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like two little legs dangling. And I created a special spice blend that wasn't too spicy, not too smoky, not too, you know, one flavor or the other, and actually dipped the prawns in that spice coating and got that really on both sides of the prawn. And then we did a Pale 31 beer batter. And then after we dipped it into the beer batter, that actually spice rub gives the beer batter something to stick to, but yet now it's very sticky. And we actually just laid that in shaved coconut and made sure that they were fully coated in that, and we fried them off, you know, really crispy. So if anything, if you start to think about the layers of flavor, you have that little bit of bitterness and that citrus flavor in just the prawn, and then you got that spice coating, which kind of again awakens your palate, and then you got the beer batter on there that kind of gets nice and crispy and fluffy and all these wonderful textures there. And then you got the coconut, which again adds a sweetness and also more texture. And Firestone makes a wonderful beer mustard, and we use that with some wonderful apricot jam that we found with whole chunks of apricot, and pureed it together with a little bit of malt vinegar. And again, that wakens the palate up. And we did this DBA apricot mustard sauce, and all those flavors together with just a few bites, your palate was just open to this whole things, you know. The second course, we did something that was really fun. We took, you know, you think about blackened shrimp or blackened, you know, catfish, but I wanted to take that blackened thought to it, just a slightly different twist. And so we did a blackened grits. So we had some wonderful corn grits. We actually infused those with squid ink and made them bright, you know, black. So again, it was a great way to play up the ideas and thought processes all the way through. But then we took solace and also some fresh corn stock. So we used corn cobs and actually made a stock with that to reinforce that corn flavor in the grits, along with their solace ale, which has just a lot of kind of saison, hefeweizen kind of undertones to it. It's malty, it's not too sweet, has some tropical essence in there. And we actually made that into the grits. And then on top of it, we did, you know, if you think about sausage, you know, it's, you know, the andouille sausage and all the other things that we love about sausage and spices. So we actually did like a mirepoix and we sauteed that off. And then we mixed in some lobster, some crayfish, and some shrimp to become a filling for squid. And squid to me is the only natural casing you could do for like a seafood sausage. And that's basically what we did, is a seafood sausage. And then it was kind of fun because we took the Nectar IPA, which is out of the other beer line that Firestone produces, and we played up those citrusy and spicy flavors in those hops, and we added some Creole mustard to it to make a like a mustard IPA sauce over the top. And so you think about all these flavors together on the plate and then pairing that with their Hefeweizen and also the Nectar IPA. That way we're showcasing the flavors that the beer was or the course was made with, but also that the beer not cooked will reinforce. And then we got the Hefeweizen with that banana clove undertone and again those spices and how everything kind of worked together on that plate. But this is also what's fun too, is because one of the, like at the very end of our kind of progression after, you know, six courses, we did red beans and rice where we did a Union Jack rice. So I actually took kind of a etouffee-ish kind of stance with a tasso ham that we made from scratch and some Firestone Walker porter. And we added that in to make kind of like a nice red bean kind of gravy sauce. And then we put that over a UJ rice. And then we actually took their Union barrel and we actually shaved it down to make a shaving. So like a wood barrel shavings. And then we used that to smoke quail that had actually been marinated in the DBA as well to reinforce those flavors. And then we, you know, smoked them till they're about medium rare and just finished them off real quick on the grill. And we did an andouille Union Jack sauce over the top. So we basically take, you know, caramelized onions and roasted garlic and, you know, a triage of flavors of a special spice blend that we use just for that dish and some roasted tomatoes and then some red bell peppers that were roasted and then andouille sausage and pureed that all together with some Union Jack to give a little bit of bitterness of that spiciness of the sauce. Pour that over. And so you have a pretty eclectic flavors all on the palate right now. And one of the things that was really fun is that if you taste Union Jack, you get a lot of citrus. I get a lot of orange, tangerine undertones to it. You know, it's bitter, but it's not too bitter. And we had everybody try that first, and I had already made a kind of a cocktail blend in the back where I had taken passion fruit juice, mango juice, peach juice, a little bit of apricot juice, along with some grenadine, which is basically pomegranate juice that's been sweetened, and then some pomegranate molasses, which is pomegranate juice that's been reduced down to almost like a maple syrup kind of consistency, and blended that all together to make kind of a hurricane cocktail. And we had the bartenders go by and actually drop about an ounce to ounce and a half in each person's glass to a 6 ounce pour. And it transformed that beer, still showing the beer flavors, but actually brought out all those unique, you know, cocktail essence of what a hurricane is without the rum, and really kind of balanced out the palate to actually kind of cool down the palate after six courses of spicy food. So, you know, this is kind of like the abridged version, but, you know, we did everything from sous vide alligator to, you know, all the way through to catfish hush puppies. And
wow.
We had a killer pecan pie made with parabola, and we did a bourbon crust on that one. And
sounds delicious. But
this is what's fun for me. I mean, it's, you know, it's its own unique thing, and each dinner I do is different. I never really do the same menu twice.
I think it's great.
Even most of the dishes are never really done twice, which I don't know if that's a travesty or not. I try to, you know, capture what it was and what that gave me as far as an idea and just expand on it for the next time around. So
now I know you also like to use beer brewing ingredients in your food as well. I mean, for example, hops, malt, those kinds of things. You know, how do you actually use beer ingredients in cooking?
Well, if you think about, so let's take a step back real quick.
Yeah.
If you think about where beer gets its flavor from, right? You know, the hops add that certain bouquet, whether it's in the aroma or the bitterness or the middle and the flavor there. Same with the malts used. You know, depending on your malt bill and the complexity and how much malt to how little malt, you know, and how those flavors intertwine. So if you start thinking about, you know, those are the basic components that make beer what it is. And so, you know, as you as a home brewer, you know, have designed a recipe, you can actually take that same ratio of grains or the dominant grain and then use that, whether it's, you know, I've done a dish where, you know, as a dessert, you could just sprinkle 120 all crystal over the top of it and you get a wonderful texture and you get all those caramel flavors without actually having a caramel sauce on the plate. Same idea with hops is that, you know, each hop varietal has its own flavor profile. And so if you stop and rethink about how to use those hops and those flavors, you know, I just was in Portland for OBF and I was working with Alan Sprints from Hair of the Dog. And we did a dinner that was really very local, a lot of fun. But he wanted to do a hop noodle as one of the courses. And so if you stop and think about a hop noodle, if we took, you know, what, let's say pelletized hops, pulverized them in with flour and then added some eggs and actually rolled out our own pasta dough, we would have a hop flavored pasta, right? But in the cooking of that pasta, whether it's a few minutes to 10 minutes, it actually is going to create bitterness, and you're going to get more bitterness than you are flavor, and that flavor is going to be lost. So that won't quite work. I've tried this in the past, and it's tricky. I'm not saying that I'm not done trying it some more, but it doesn't work as well as you would want. So instead, you know, you can do, let's say, a hop tea, you know, so you think about, you know, at the end of your whirlpool, you add all those hops and that flavor that comes through in your brew. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, you're cooking the hops, you're boiling the hops, and as it, the longer it boils, just like when you put them at 90 minutes versus the last 5 minutes, it changes the flavor profile. And again, it doesn't quite get those flavors all the way through the pasta.
Probably aromatics, so, right? You're looking for those aromatic oils that tend to boil off very quickly, right?
Exactly. And also to get enough aromatics into that water that you're actually going to cook the pasta in and actually stick to that pasta, it's not going to quite work the same. And so what we ended up doing that I find that works out real well is that, you know, if you happen to have one of the SIS whipped cream canisters that you can make your own whipped cream with nitrous with, you can actually add vodka to that. And depending on the hop varietal, we actually used Amarillo because Amarillo were used in the beer that we actually were pairing with. And, you know, it's about a quarter of an ounce to about a pint of vodka, just a simple 40 proof vodka works fine, and screw it on, hit it with nitrous. And after 2 minutes to 10 minutes, you get this wonderful hop infused vodka and you can actually just squirt it out. And we basically cook the pasta. And anybody who knows, when you cook pasta and you remove it from the water, it almost wants to suck it up. And so when you put it into your pot with your sauce, it soaks up that sauce and it works great. Well, we actually did the same idea with this hop vodka. And if you think about it, we're not cooking the hops at all. The pasta has been removed from 212 degree water, you know, sea level, and then we've added that in, tossed it instead of adding butter or olive oil, and that basically infused into the noodles themselves, and the vodka is actually kind of dissipating off. And then we did a braised pig tongue and lamb and pig cheeks, and we had cooked the tongue in that was the Doggy Claws, his winter brew, and then we did a Adam that we did the lamb cheeks and the pig cheeks in with a whole bunch of aromatics, drained the meat off from the stock and then took that stock, reduced it down to almost a demi-glace consistency and added in some creme fraiche and kind of did a beef stroganoff, if you will, but with those other wonderful parts that just are so tender and rich when you braise them for a long, slow period of time. And then just to give it another counterpoint, we added in some of the Cypress Grove goat cheese, Humboldt Fog over the top, just to give it a real nice pop. And then what that did with Michael and Bob, which are two sour beers that Alan creates that are just really wonderful flavor profiles. And again, how those all work together and those hops were just, those hop noodles just were that great fun base to the dish. So
all this talk about food's making me hungry here, Sean. So. You sent some food this way.
I know. I'm sorry. I forgot to give you the disclosure, you know, in advance.
But where would you recommend the listeners go if they want to learn more about, you know, food pairing or cooking with beer or even beer cuisine?
Sadly, there's not a whole lot of places you can go that just focus in on just that.
Homebrewchef.com.
Well, there's, I mean, I was going to, you know, thank you, Brad. One thing I would actually recommend all your listeners to do is next time you're at a homebrew meeting or you have friends over at the house or you're brewing beer and you're a little bit more organized, stop and actually think about like, okay, I'm going to create this dish and I'm going to use these flavors. And I think these beers would go really well with it. And you can even do it like a potluck and say, hey, if you guys have, you know, certain beers or certain styles of beer that you can like, I want everybody to bring beers from just this one. And then, you know, have 8, 10, 12 different beers in that same category or style that can actually be paired with that dish or just even randomly like with a cheese tasting and actually kind of go back and forth and see what works and what doesn't. Because again, it's subjective, but there is some rhyme and reason to it. And the more you kind of start to play with your own palate and what your flavors are like, you can actually really get some wonderful stuff. And I'm hoping to have some new content on my website shortly here on this topic. And, you know, craftbeer.com does a great job too. They have some fun information up there. So there's a lot of places you can look. But again, I'm still haven't really found the exact, like, you know, this is everything. And, you know, I don't want to say that I'm that yet, but we're working on it. So,
well, Sean, thank you very much. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Any topics we maybe didn't cover?
All day. I mean, basically, one thing you might want to think about too is you design your dishes or design your menu is to really stop and think about byproduct flavors. So, you know, if you're a BJCP judge or an AHA judge, you know, and you judge, you know, a beer competition, you know, there's certain flavor profiles, whether it's acetaldehyde or apple pear flavors, or, you know, you have the DMS, you know, the cooked vegetables, you know, you also look at diacetyl with that butterscotch kind of undertone to really think about those off flavors. And if you introduce those as components into your dish, whether you're using a lot of cooked corn, let's say, or cooked cabbage into a dish, and that beer that you're going to pair with might have trace very limited amounts of it, as you drink that beer and you have it with that cooked corn puree or you know, those flavors in the dish, whether it's even like an apple chutney, can actually really enhance those flaws in the beer. Mm-hmm. And I don't really think that that respects the beer as much as it could. And so if you stop and really, you know, it's almost like that fourth, you know, dimension of flavors and start to really dive into, you know, what makes that beer style what it is and really try to hone in on those flavors, whether it's the roast, the toast, the caramel, the toffee, all the way through the bread and you know, same with the hops and same with the yeast and think up those different flavors and really showcase those unique qualities that that beer represents versus just throwing it in there just because, you know, it's not just the can of beer into the chili, you know, just to make it full circle. So,
well, Sean, we've only just scratched the surface here, but I wanted some of the folks in the audience to get a chance to hear you talk and sort of get them thinking along these lines, because I just found the whole experience to be very interesting. The idea of you know, homebrewed cuisine and beer cuisine. I'd like to thank you very much for being on the show, though. Thank you for being here, Sean.
Oh, thank you, Brad. And I think it's a great forum. You know, what you're providing both from your software and your podcast. You know, I think it's, I mean, I've been using Beersmith for a very long time, and I love that it organizes everything for me and it does all the math for me. And it allows me to think outside the box a lot more, where I don't have to think about all the math and the science as much.
I thought it was interesting too. Sean and I were talking at the conference about you were using the water tool to create bread or something. Is that right?
Water profile. That's one tool? Of the things that you'll see more information on. But if you play with the water chemistry, there's a lot to be said about I really got the idea from pizza, and everybody talks about how New York pizza crust is the best crust in the country. And if you use the same flour, the same yeast, the same olive oil, you know, it's there's not a whole lot that goes into a pizza crust, but water is a huge dominant, you know, thing. And what's funny is that I actually saw there was a show where they did water from, I think it was San Francisco or LA. They had water from Denver and water from New York, and they did the same exact ingredients outside of the water, the same proportions, the same kneading, the same temperature oven. They kept everything separated, and they gave three different pies to the judges to actually try, and all three of them were like, this is the New York, and they all got it just dead right. I mean, it was like there was no question at all. And so if you stop and you think about, well, water chemistry, well, we can strip water down and we can rebuild it up, and your software is great for that. You know, and the fact you can actually do it in, like, you know, 1 gallon, you know, increments, and actually create, like, you know, your gallon jug of New York water, and then use that for your bagels or for your pizza crust, you'll actually get a much better pizza crust because of it, and it all comes down to those minerals.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting. Obviously, we all know how important water is in beer, but I really hadn't thought about, you know, using it in bread or pizza crust or other things like that. A very, very innovative idea, Sean.
Well, and it was fun too, because your software makes it a lot easier to come up with those calculations than anything else that I found. So, you know, I do that at home, and, you know, I've recreated the water from West Veleteren to West Mall, and it really does make a huge difference in the beer. And I'm like, well, why wouldn't this make a big difference in the food too? I mean, it's kind of the same thing. I mean, if you really stop and think about, you know, from a brewer to a chef back to a brewer, we're doing the same thought process. It's just understanding those ingredients and be able to talk about them in a more, you know, dynamic way, and those flavor profiles and what the water does, I think, is huge. And not a lot of people focus in on that. And it does make a huge difference. And even trying to understand, you know, the pH and all the other things that go with that. So I have to thank you a little bit for all your help with that.
Well, thank you, Sean. And again, that was the great Sean Z. Paxton, the Homebrew Chef, and his website is at homebrewchef.com. Well, that wraps up the show for this week. I'd like to thank you again for listening. If you have any feedback for the show, you can leave it under this episode at beersmith.com/blog, or you can join us on the discussion forum at beersmith.com/forum under the podcast section. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.